Cheap natural gas is already replacing coal, but it's also contributing to the decline of a carbon-neutral fuel.
So if your concern is about climate change and you view it as an urgent threat, then you should be very concerned about the closure of nuclear power plants.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, are we hanging nuclear power out to dry? Plus, our wildlife series continues with a little migratory bird.
It bobs its tail, so it basically looks like it's dancing constantly. It's really fun to see.
What's not fun is what fracking is doing to its habitat. And as coyotes move into cities, we have to face them and our myths about them.
Coyotes will not stay away from your neighborhood if you remove the one you've seen. New coyotes will arrive to take its place. That's totally coyote.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We start the show with some coal news. Pennsylvania's Environmental Hearing Board gave CONSOL Energy the go-ahead to mine beneath a stream in Greene County. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Last year, the panel of judges ruled against two other mining permits that allowed CONSOL to conduct longwall mining beneath streams in Ryerson Station State Park. Environmental groups had opposed those permits because longwall mining can cause the ground beneath streams to fall in. When that happens, water can flow into the cracks and the streams can run dry. But in March, the Department of Environmental Protection decided CONSOL's plans to fix any cracks it caused in Poland Run by filling them with grout were acceptable. It issued a mining permit to the company, which the environmental groups appealed. This time, the judges agreed with the company. They said some damage was expected, but said new data showed other streams impacted by longwall mining are now recovering. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Following a settlement with environmental groups, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is drafting new water pollution permits for 10 coal-fired power plants. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk has more from a recent public hearing on the permit for the Cheswick Generating Station near Pittsburgh.
These updated permits spell out how much of various pollutants each plant can release into rivers and streams. Cheswick has been operating on extensions of a permit that expired in 2012. The DEP says the new permit does not weaken existing pollution limits, and it sets the level for boron. It also bolsters stormwater monitoring. The permit takes into account Obama-era guidelines for pollutants like arsenic and mercury, assuming the Trump administration does not rescind them. Patrick Grenter with the Sierra Club says he would like to see DEP implement the federal guidelines sooner than 2023. That's when they're slated to take effect.
This would give the plant more time to continue to dump toxics into the Allegheny River, the drinking water source for much of Allegheny County.
Cheswick's manager says even though the current permit has expired, the facility still has to comply with pollution limits. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Later in the show, we'll have more energy news. How one of coal power's competitors is fading, and some say that's bad for the environment. People always pay attention to weather patterns, say, to see if we need an umbrella. Well, Rebecca Williams reports it's just as important for scientists to track and predict the movement of birds. People who study them are now using radar to create maps that can forecast bird migration at night.
Researchers say these maps could help birds by reducing the number of collisions with buildings and wind turbines. Kyle Horton is a postdoctoral research fellow with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He says the maps show nightly predictions of migratory activity 1 to 3 days into the future. Horton's team is drawing on a radar infrastructure he says is pretty unique to the United States. It's called the NEXRAD system.
These radars are traditionally used for studying meteorology, looking at precipitation, severe storms, but they also capture a tremendous amount of biology.
Horton says they can extract the number of birds that are migrating on a given night and link that up with atmospheric conditions. He says the map shows the intensity of migration, and that can vary night to night, and it can vary around the country.
So one night may see really great migration, let's say, in around the Gulf of Mexico. But the next night, migration may shut down, and that may be because of, you know, a wind that is opposing these migrants. And hopefully, you know, those migrants, at least from a birdwatcher's perspective, would make landfall, and you could go out and observe those birds the next day.
So besides the maps being helpful to birdwatchers, Horton says the maps could be used to reduce bird kills.
So let's say a large building or lights at night, wind turbines, any of those impacts, hopefully we can mitigate those by giving the folks that make those decisions enough of a warning to say there's a large migration coming. If you can make some mitigation strategy available, we hope that that will be in place now.
That might mean building managers could get a heads up when a lot of birds are flying through at night and turn off lights so the lights don't confuse the birds, causing them to collide with the building. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
People love Lake Erie, swimming, boating, and fishing there. Plus, some people rely on it for drinking water. But there's a danger from pollution that's led Ohio to take action.
I mean, all of this leading up to getting this impaired designation is just the first step. It's just a shame that it's taken this long.
Coming up on the Allegheny Front, the struggle to keep Lake Erie safe for all to enjoy. Stay tuned. One of the biggest unknowns about the shale gas boom is how it's affecting wildlife. But a new study about a little warbler is helping to change that. The Louisiana water thrush is one of the first migratory songbirds to appear in our region. And though it's kind of a drab brown color, it's easy to recognize.
It bobs its tail, so it basically looks like it's dancing constantly, and it's really fun to see. The cool thing about their song, though, is that it's higher pitched. You can tell it was designed to carry over the sound of water.
Mac France is a PhD candidate at West Virginia University, who recently published a journal article about how shale gas development is impacting the species.
The Louisiana water thrush is the proverbial canary in the coal mine. It breeds along forested headwater streams in the Appalachian region, and they set up territories they defend along the stream. They feed on little stream invertebrates, so mayflies, crayfish, stuff like that. Their whole life cycle is tied to the stream. If something happens to that stream, its habitat, its food resources, then we should be able to see some kind of measurable effect.
So you looked at habitat in West Virginia where there has been increasing activity from the gas industry. What does the landscape look like?
West Virginia, for the most part, is still predominantly forested. It's a super forested, even more so than decades ago. So a lot of that second, third growth forest has returned. But you do see a lot of forest fragmentation. It's not really so much the placement of a well pad, but it's all the infrastructure it takes in order to access that well pad and also to transfer the gas. So your access road, pipelines, you know, compressor stations. And so, you know, in areas where maybe you used to have contiguous forested habitat, which it's important to have for certain kinds of wildlife, you know, now it might be broken up.
France and the research team looked at aerial and satellite images of gas development and spent hours in the field from 2009 to 2011 when unconventional drilling began and was peaking, and then again from 2013 to 2015. They also monitored water thrush nests and territories.
Nest survival decreased, so the probability that a water thrush nest is going to be successful over its 29-day nesting period, that was lower due to shale gas development. We also saw that shale gas disturbed areas were producing less fledglings.
Anne France says the riparian habitat quality declined in areas where there was gas development. That means water quality in the streams, but also erosion of stream banks and a loss of native plants. And if I'm reading the study correctly, the size of the water thrush territories increased.
The water thrush, they really like pristine forested areas, you know, so forest cover intact, and that means that their aquatic prey is associated to, you know, that high canopy cover of the forest, And then if you start to remove some of that forest cover, that's going to affect their food resources. You know, some of those very sensitive prey, both to forest cover and also surface water pollution and contaminants, some of that food resource might start to disappear. And so you might have originally had a small territory that had the amount of food resources you needed, but once those food resources are affected in some way, then that means you're going to have to increase the area that you're looking for that food resource. And so I think in part that's what we're seeing here, is that, you know, as these once, you know, pristine forested areas are starting to be fragmented and changing the aquatic prey, that the water thrush are having to have a larger territory to support their foraging needs, not only for themselves, but for their nestlings.
From what I've read, it sounds like your study is one of the first of its kind looking at fracking and songbird populations. What does your research say about the future of Louisiana water thrush populations and about birds and gas infrastructure in general?
What I think my study shows is that it doesn't take a large disturbance or impact on the landscape to see pretty significant negative effects to a wildlife population. The study area is still like more than 91% forested, so it's still heavily forested, yet we're still seeing these effects.
Yeah, are you hoping that your findings could be used to influence policy around the oil and gas industry?
I would hope so, yes. I'm not allowed to give recommendations or, you know, management recommendations per se, but, you know, we definitely need to assess current setback regulations we have and such and evaluate, should we allow infrastructure and development to be this close to a forested headwater stream where all our public drinking water comes from? It is warranted, you know, to try to reevaluate some of these regulations that are existing and see if they need beefed up or if we need new ones.
Mac France is a PhD candidate at West Virginia University and part of the USGS Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. There's more on his paper and research at AlleghenyFront.org. And that's where you can find other stories in our series, Wild PA. Stay tuned, because later in the show, there's another wildlife story about a species that's been skulking around the edges of human civilization for thousands of years. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Natural gas has been touted as a bridge between coal and a clean energy future, and its low price is outcompeting some coal plants. Gas is having a similar effect on another big power source that emits no carbon pollution, nuclear energy. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Fraser reports this could be a setback in the fight against climate change.
It was just four short years ago when an American president said this about natural gas.
If extracted safely, it's the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change.
President Obama's prediction became partially true. Hundreds of coal plants have closed, but now something else is happening too. Inside the Three Mile Island nuclear plant, a reactor creates enough electricity to power 800,000 homes, but the plant is slated to shut down next year. Inside a control room, shift manager Nick Favorito says he hopes that doesn't happen.
We're hopeful that we'll work with the PA legislature to find a solution to keep these plants running, since they are carbon-free source electricity, a large carbon-free source electricity.
But it might be tough for the plant's owner, Exelon, to keep it online. The plant can't make money in an electricity market flooded by cheap natural gas. Researcher Jesse Jenkins says that's bad news for the climate.
So if your concern is about climate change and you view it as an urgent and perhaps even existential threat to human society and to the environment, then you should be very concerned about the closure of nuclear power plants. And indeed, it's the thing that keeps me up most at night right now.
Jenkins is a PhD candidate at MIT who studies ways to lower the carbon footprint of the electric grid. He He says nuclear plants around the country are retiring much sooner than they have to. In addition to Three Mile Island, First Energy announced it was closing three of its nuclear plants in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Jenkins says each of these are large sources of carbon-free electricity that'll probably be replaced by natural gas, which emits the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide, though not as much as coal.
And losing each one is a significant step back at a time we should be making rapid progress towards a zero-carbon energy system.
An industry-funded study found the four nuclear plants scheduled to close in Ohio and Pennsylvania provide more emissions-free electricity than all the wind and solar in the entire Mid-Atlantic region. To stay in business, nuclear plant owners are turning to states and the federal government for help. First Energy has asked the federal government to declare a grid emergency to keep its coal and nuclear plants running. New York and Illinois are subsidizing struggling nuclear plants by giving them zero emissions credits. Matt Wald is with the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry trade group. He says the credits are necessary.
We are seeking to have the market recognize the things that we provide to the system. It doesn't do that now.
Nuclear's precarious situation creates a problem for environmental groups. Tom Schuster is with the Sierra Club in Pennsylvania.
It's a complicated issue for us.
Schuster says there are climate benefits with nuclear, but also environmental problems.
We also have concerns about pollution from nuclear energy in the form of radioactive waste that we haven't really figured out a great way to deal with, and also mining of the uranium fuel and the processing of that fuel, which is very energy intensive and can lead to toxic pollution.
But it's still the country's top source of carbon-free electricity. So the Sierra Club supported state bailouts for nuclear that also promoted renewables.
I kind of think about it as thinking about nuclear plant policy as a phase-out rather than a bailout.
The best way to get this to happen, he says, is through a carbon tax. But that's unlikely at the federal level right now. So could Pennsylvania bail out its nuclear industry? Maybe. But the state's large natural gas industry opposes any bailout for nuclear, and there are no bills in the legislature to do so right now. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Now that warm weather finally seems to be approaching, you might be thinking about a visit to the Great Lakes. Lake Erie has been making all kinds of headlines. Just this month, shipwreck hunters announced plans to excavate the wreckage of a schooner that experts believe sank in Lake Erie, possibly during a violent storm nearly 200 years ago. But the water quality in Lake Erie is currently in the midst of a political storm. Research released by the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency on the lake's toxic algae shows there's been no clear decrease in the pollutants feeding the persistent blooms over the last 5 years. This despite billions of dollars in investments to reduce the pollution load. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has been looking into this and is here with me now. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Kara.
So what are we talking about when we say toxic algae blooms in Western Lake Erie?
Well, these harmful algae blooms have been getting the public's attention since at least 2011 in the western basin of Lake Erie, around Toledo. The water looks thick. It's like pea soup, and it can be kind of a disturbing bright green color. It can kill wildlife and pets and make people sick. It really got noticed in 2014. That's when the algal toxin microcystin poisoned the tap water, distributed to 500,000 people in the Toledo area for 3 days.
And what's known about where the pollution comes from?
Well, it's been known for many years now that excess nutrients like nitrogen and especially phosphorus feed the blooms. In a webinar held this week analyzing water quality, the Ohio EPA's Kathy Alexander gave the latest numbers.
Approximately 88% of the annual load from the Maumee River to Lake Erie comes from non-point sources. So we would certainly say at this point that a lot of the loading is coming from agriculture.
That means farms, from both commercial fertilizer that's sprayed on crops and manure from large animal feeding operations that find their way into the water.
So what happened after the drinking water crisis in 2014 in terms of the government's response?
Well, Ohio joined various multi-state agreements and created its own plan for reducing pollution going into the lake. The state also set its own goal of reducing the phosphorus runoff 20% by the year 2020 and 40% by the year 2025. The Ohio Farm Bureau Federation says it's been working with farmers on a lot of volunteer measures to reduce runoff of manure and fertilizers into the water. But then in another recent report, the state said data showed that so far, that's not making any difference. The EPA looked at nutrient loads from 2013 through 2017 into Ohio waterways and found no trend of overall decrease into Western Lake Erie.
Yeah, I understand the state of Ohio recently declared the waters of Lake Erie as officially impaired. What does that mean?
Well, yeah, as you said, in March, the Ohio EPA announced it would designate the open waters of Lake Erie's western basin as impaired for recreation because of harmful algae and for drinking water because of the toxin microcystin. This is something both Michigan and Ontario have already done. Now, an impaired designation requires the state to put some kind of plan in place to reduce pollution. This action by Ohio still needs approval from the U.S. EPA.
I mean, all of this leading up to getting this impaired designation is just the first step. It's just a shame that it's taken this long.
Now, this is Mike Ferner. He started a group called Advocates for a Clean Lake Erie, which was party to a federal lawsuit on this issue. The judge in that case recently gave the U.S. EPA 30 days to rule on Ohio's impaired status.
Assuming that the U.S. EPA approves Ohio's recommendation for the impaired status, then that begins a process under the Clean Water Act to inventory the pollution, to find out the sources and amounts. And this means a lot of in-the-field testing, and we're advocating that it be done under the provisions of the Clean Water Act, and that we go all the way back to the headwaters and sample these streams and ditches that wind up flowing into Lake Erie.
That process could also require that farms create nutrient management plans so they can be held accountable for phosphorus and nitrogen pollution. Ferner says big animal feeding operations especially should be held accountable for runoff.
So I'm guessing that big farm groups have something to say about this.
Yes, of course. Larry Antosh is director of environmental policy with the Ohio Farm Bureau. He says the state has created new laws already requiring farmers to get certified to apply fertilizer and putting limits on when it can be applied to reduce runoff. He says the state needs to slow down and see if these new regulations make a difference.
Natural systems take time to readjust. And there is a lag time from an agricultural system anywhere from, 10 years plus in order for the changes in the landscape, what we're doing in the fields, start showing up in some of the stream monitoring stations.
And, Kara, I'd like to point out that the Toledo Blade newspaper, which has covered this extensively, published an editorial to that response to slow down farm regulation. It was entitled Lake Erie Shame.
Okay, well, I guess that kind of sums up their view of Ohio's efforts.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Julie.
Sure thing.
There's more from the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant on Lake Erie and all of her other great reporting on agriculture and lots of other topics. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. According to the Pennsylvania Game Commission, from the summer of 2016 through last July, their wildlife officers received 50 calls about coyotes in Allegheny County. Most of the phone calls were just to say someone had heard one. If the sound or thought of coyotes makes your heart beat a little faster with fear, Allegheny Front contributor Kate St. John is here with some history and common sense advice.
Last fall, a coyote made a splash in my Pittsburgh neighborhood just by showing up. We were all surprised and a little shocked when it was seen in someone's backyard. Have coyotes suddenly arrived in the city? I saw a dead coyote by a local highway in 2003. He was probably not the first. Eastern coyotes look a little bit like German shepherds, but smaller with shaggier fur. Their size and presence in cities has a lot to do with how we've treated coyotes and wolves. By the early 1900s, Americans had eliminated wolves and mountain lions from most of the U.S. Then we tried to eradicate coyotes, but it backfired. When coyote populations are under stress, they automatically produce more pups. Without wolves as natural competitors, coyotes spread from coast to coast. In a weird twist of fate and survival, wolves and coyotes hybridized in Ontario. That resulted in a larger coyote in the east, a third larger than western coyotes, weighing 35 to 55 pounds. Coyotes arrived in Pennsylvania in the 1930s when our reintroduced deer population was exploding. They fill up on fawns and roadkill when they can. Mice, rats, and plants are staples of their diet, but they also eat Canada goose goslings. As these foods expanded into cities, so did coyotes. So, are coyotes something we should worry about? Are they dangerous? Not to us humans, but we have plenty of myths borrowed from our fear of wolves. No, coyotes won't eat your kids. No, coyotes won't lure your dog away to make a meal of it, but they might take a small pet if it looks easy. No, coyotes will not stay away from your neighborhood if you remove the one you've seen. New coyotes will arrive to take its place. That's totally coyote. What you want to do is train your local coyotes to be wary of humans. Never feed coyotes. Don't leave any food outdoors either, including pet food or open garbage. You'll attract mice or rats, and they attract coyotes. Keep your dog on leash and stay with your small pet when you let it out in the yard. Keep your cat indoors. If you see a coyote, shout and wave your arms. Shoo it away. Coyotes are smart, and our pressure on them makes them even smarter. Appreciate them from afar. Keep them wild. You'll be very lucky if you ever see one.
Kate St. John blogs about nature and birds at Outside My Window. There's a link over at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And if you have questions about what to do if you do come face to face with a coyote, you'll find more about that there too. It's part of our series, Wild PA, where we talk to scientists, conservation groups, and regular people as they work to protect wildlife in Pennsylvania. AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. Get the latest episodes at TrumponEarth.org. I'm Kara Holsapel. See you next time.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.